You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with the booming strains of Ludwig van Beethoven. Is it van Beethoven or von Beethoven? It's von Beethoven, right?
It's von.
Is it von Beethoven?
Wait a minute. No, we got it wrong, I think. I think von. It's Ludwig van.
Is it? Okay.
I can still hear Malcolm McDowell talking about a little of the old Ludwig van. I'm pretty sure it is van.
All right. Okay. Yeah. You know, whose name it sounds terribly impressive in to English speakers, but then you find out it means beet farmer, which is really, what a letdown, you know.
A man of the earth, the farmer.
The beet farmer, Ludwig the beet farmer. So, yes, and he really knew how to lay down a beet. Hello? Hello?
These are the jokes, kids.
Okay.
So, that's okay.
Anyone there? So we are here today, as you can tell from his dulcet tones coming through on the other end. We're here today on this fine Wednesday with Mr. Rod Bennett.
Yep,
how you doing,
again.
Rod? Yes. So it's the new year. You are one of the millions who survived into the new year and did not die a celebrity death.
So even if I had died, it wouldn't have been a celebrity death.
Well, okay. It would have been a loss to me. So
that's very nice of you to say so.
Every day that, you know, that ticks past where you're still here is a good one. So
not taking a dirt nap yet. So
that's good. That's good. You had a good, I trust, a good Christmas and New Year?
We did. It was pretty quiet. Went to see my parents in Atlanta.
Okay.
And we usually spend Christmas Day with them.
Yeah.
And that was good. And okay. Yeah, all was quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah, we had a good Christmas. One of my favorite Christmas moments over the last about 2 weeks before Christmas, we had a Christmas party at my son Luke's house. And that happened to be the morning when it was the morning after Rogue One had debuted. And so my son Matthew and like all of his friends and others of my sons who are not Luke all decided that this was the day they were going to all go see Rogue One. So this had all been planned, even though there was a big Christmas party about to happen at Luke's house. So what we did was Jan and I went over to Luke's house to help prep for the party. And everybody met there, including various cousins and so forth. And they all took off to go see Rogue One. And we babysat Matthew's two little girls, Seraphim, who is two, and Charlotte, who just turned one on the 29th of December.
Pretty good.
So it was just us boring grandparents who didn't go. Plus Luke stayed home because the party was at his house. And so he was trying to do party prep. So we're bustling around Luke's house and we're setting up food and getting everything ready for the big party. Cause everybody's going to come back from Rogue One and then it's going to be party time all the rest of the day. And so, Luke's little girl's named Lucy, and Seraphim adores Lucy. She loves Lucy so much. Lucy is this remote godlike figure who can do anything because she is seven and Seraphim is only two.
Seven is a big deal when you're two.
Seven's a big deal, and so Seraphim just thinks the world of Lucy. So Seraphim disappears into Lucy's room and is in there playing. And Luke finally just pokes his head in the room.
Good
just
idea.
Just to say howdy and, you know, see what Seraphim is up to.
Mm-hmm.
And so he pokes his head in the room, and Seraphim's in there, and she instantly ducks down behind some big toy of Lucy's, and she's just kind of peeking at Luke through the toy. And so Luke, still just being friendly Uncle Luke, who, by the way, Seraphim can't say Luke's name, so she calls him Dude. That's Uncle Dude. Which is super adorable as well.
That's pretty good.
And so Luke looks in the room, and she ducks down behind this toy, and he says, hey, Seraphim, you having fun in here? And Seraphim goes, no, I didn't.
I suspect this prompted an investigation.
Actually, we looked around. We couldn't see what was going on. She felt incredibly guilty about something. We have never figured out what it was.
Oh.
but it was such a great reply. So one other time. Last summer, Luke just happened to poke his head in the room. And again, Seraphim had gone in there and was, you know, was playing. And it was the middle of summer. It was a hot day. He stuck his head in there, and there was Seraphim. She had taken her pants off, and she was bouncing on the bed. And Luke looked in, and before he could say a word, she just froze, and she looked at him and goes,
So,
two moments of extreme childhood guilt for, we really haven't quite figured out what exactly. I think maybe in the bed bouncing case, it was just she had this feeling she shouldn't be bouncing on the bed, even though she couldn't hurt the bed. She's too little. But it was just great. So we had a great Christmas.
That
great Christmas
great.
Party.
That
I got a
great.
lovely copy. I got a couple of things. I got this lovely copy from my wife of At the Back of the North Wind by George MacDonald.
Oh, wonderful. That's
beautiful
great.
Illustrations and everything. So that
That's
made
one
me
of the
super...
best ones, yeah.
It really is. Yeah, I'd been wanting to get it, and Jan beat me to it for Christmas, so that was great.
That's great.
Yeah, awesome. So it's just been good. And
George MacDonald for Christmas seems appropriate.
Yeah, that's the way I felt too. Was just that's my yummy Christmas present. We've had real cold here over
I've
the last
heard a little
couple of
that,
days.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's been
unusually so.
Yeah, down in the 20s and bright blue, not a cloud in the sky, so there's just nothing to keep the heat in. So,
feel Christmassy, huh?
Yep, so it was good. How about you? Did Santa bring you anything fun?
Well, you know, I usually get, Santa Claus knows my weakness for Blu-rays. So he doesn't always know what exact titles I'm looking for. And he knows that I'm kind of particular.
Okay.
So I have this Amazon wish list that he can go into and and look and see where my taste run towards this season. And Santa Claus, I think, finds Amazon to be a pretty good convenience. So
he knows if you've been sleeping. He knows if you're awake. He knows what your Blu-ray wish list is.
That's right. Okay. And it saves him at least one stop along the way. When you know, if you've got to make all these hundreds of millions of stops in one night, every little bit helps. So
yeah. Somebody,
maybe
I
they
think
can
did
one of these Amazon delivery drones. Maybe they'll disguise it to look like a sleigh, you know.
The skeet fleet.
That's right.
That's what I call it. It's just a matter of time. It's sure to
make a tempting target for our gun rights friends.
People tell me that you should shop local and not patronize Amazon, but of course I live in Seattle, so I am shopping local.
Does Jeff Bezos, is that his name? Does he bring it in person?
Jeff? Yeah. He shows up personally at my house and, yeah. I don't know where Bezos lives. It may be in Seattle, but I kind of assume he must live in Seattle, but I could be wrong.
All the rest of those kind of people live in Seattle.
I've seen, for example, I've seen Paul Allen's supervillain lair. He actually has a supervillain lair. At least that's what I call it. Up in the San Juan Islands. That's kind of exciting to go to, you know.
I bet so.
He's there, you know, negotiating with world leaders, agreeing not to aim his death ray at the Empire State Building and the Eiffel Tower. You know,
right.
If they'll accede to his demands. I think we're just about up against a break here. The music should come crashing in, and there it is. And when we return, I thought we'd spend a little bit of time talking about the mystery of prayer. So you're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. We were talking over the break about beloved films, and we wound up talking about one of the rare movies where Malcolm McDowell plays a good guy. He always plays really nasty people, it seems. But he was a good guy in a sleeper hit called Time After Time that came out in 1978, 79,
79,
right?
79, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and where he plays H.G. Wells, who in the film actually really builds a time machine.
Same author wrote a similar story a couple years earlier called The 7% Solution, where Sherlock Holmes meets Sigmund Freud. And this one's a variation on the same idea. H.G. Wells meets Jack the Ripper.
Okay.
And both of them are very clever, cleverly written.
That sounds like something that Tim Powers would do. Tim Powers is an interesting fantasy writer, too.
Yeah.
Catholic guy.
After Time After Time, the writer we're talking about, Nicholas Meyer, made Star Trek II, which is
very beloved
by geeky people everywhere.
That's right. It was funny. He's one of many people. It seems like people that make Star Trek movies, a lot of times it's like they knew nothing about Star Trek until they got
sometimes
hired
this
to
works out. Sometimes it Star doesn't, Trek. In my
yes.
judgment. But
but he really nailed it. You know, he sat down, he watched a bunch of Star Trek episodes and finally said, you know, that one with Khan, that seems like we could like tap into that story and use it again.
And they brought him back a few movies later for number 6, which is the one where they do the collapse of the Soviet Union in space.
Oh, yeah.
The undiscovered country. And that one's better in some ways, too. So.
Yes. And he keeps bringing back the same actor. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. The guy that played Jack the Ripper.
David Warner.
David, that's it.
He's great.
Who plays a great villain, but also... He was a good guy in the Undiscovered Country. Also, the guy can be really funny too. He played the evil genius in another time travel movie called Time Bandits.
Right. I thought you might mention that. That's right.
Devil
himself under the title Evil Genius, and he's great, hilarious too.
Yes, he has these complaints about God, you know. Why does he make 43 species of parrots, you know?
Yes, and typically brilliant writing from the Monty Python guys. So.
Yes, and he complains, he goes, nipples for men, right?
Right. You know, I met a man once at a Christian music festival who told me he'd been converted to Christianity by watching Time After Time while high.
Really?
he was very stoned, he said, and he watched Time After Time, and all of the religious aspects of it were all mind-blowingly mind-opening to him. And he sobered up, straightened up, and sought Christian guidance. So the Lord sure do move in mysterious ways. Huh?
Isn't that something?
True story.
It's a weird world, you know. People.
God does not let himself without a witness.
Yep, that's pretty. Good.
Well, George Harrison was the producer of that movie, and he's a guy who's famous for having mused over religious topics more than many people. And
was it time after some of it.
But,
was it Time After Time or Time Bandits?
Time Bandits.
That he was what? Oh, that's
George Harrison
stranger.
was one of the producers.
No, I'm talking about your friend, the guy. He was watching Time Bandits or Time After Time?
Time Bandits, yes. Watching David Warner as the devil in Time Bandits.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I may have misspoke. I don't know.
It's also the villain in he's been a villain in a lot of stories, but he was the villain in Titanic.
Yep. He's the guy who gets his head spectacularly cut off in The Omen.
Yes.
That's him.
And he was trying to be a good guy, you know, warning.
He's the guy in the famous torture scene, torturing Captain Picard, trying to get him to admit that there's, what is it, three lights when there's really only two?
Something like that.
One of the more memorable Next Generation episodes.
Yeah, he could be a really great villain, you know.
Right.
But, anyway, I thought we might spend a little time today talking about prayer. For various reasons, it's the new year, and the new year is we associate the new year with, you know, doing things like praying in the new year. The church always starts the new year with prayer, so we dedicate the first day of the year to Mary, and we have the Solemnity of Mary. And the phenomenon of prayer. I've been thinking about it lately. I've got a friend who's been. I actually have a number of friends who are struggling with depression and so forth. And one friend of mine, in particular, had a real crisis a few days ago. He's out here in Seattle, and you know, wound up checking himself into, you know, a clinic because it was partly it's emotional things and partly it's they'd given him some kind of, you know, antidepressant drugs or something, and anyway there was like this weird reaction to the drugs, and he was having a really, really hard time.
Sorry to hear about it.
Yeah, but wound up praying for him. And I've seen this happen before, just felt a really strong, it was impressed on me, the need to pray for him, and to make him a regular subject of prayers. So I'm trying to do that. And, you know, in the mystery of God, I have no idea what my prayers do, or, you know, how much of it is pharmacology and how much of it is brain chemistry and, you know, whatever. But he's doing better. And it brings, the whole question of prayer. We're commanded to do it.
Well, you used the term the mystery of prayer a few moments ago, and that struck me as an appropriate way to talk about it, because it is it's such a simple thing. It's one of the first things you learn as a Christian, to say your prayers at bedtime.
Right.
And yet it really is right at the very profoundest heart of the mystery of God.
Right.
I don't want to say it doesn't make sense, but in really important ways it doesn't, and it causes us to rely on authority, on tradition. In other words, we're commanded to do it, as you said a minute ago, in spite of the fact that there are so many things about it that baffle the intellect.
Right. Right. Such as, why do it at all? You know, what's the point of asking?
If you run into atheists or skeptics, one of the first things they'll ask you is, well, if God is all good, why does he have to be asked to do the right thing?
Right.
If he's all powerful, why doesn't he just go ahead and do it rather than sitting around waiting to be asked?
Right.
All of these are extremely profound questions. In other words, You've gone from your very first childhood lesson in being a Christian to some of the deepest depths that nobody, even our greatest doctors, have been able to really plumb. You know,
right?
And yeah. That's interesting. You're quickly required to rely on tradition. Christians pray. However, you've got it figured out that it's not necessary or that it makes no sense or whatever, Christians pray.
Right. And it's one of the first things that Jesus, you know, obviously talks about doing. And when it's curious because Jesus says, your heavenly Father knows what you need before you ask him. A Greek logician would look at that and then say, well, then why bother praying?
right. Well, one of the, not many people probably have sat around and puzzled out the philosophy of it all, but I think most people back into it in their own way. Like a popular thing you see on social media these days, there's a meme that says, prayer isn't about changing God, it's about God changing you. And there's variations on it. In other words, pray not to change God's mind or to change some attitude of his, but to change you.
Right.
And that sounds great. It's definitely somebody wrestling with this mystery of what's it all for, if God knows everything and is all good and all powerful, etc. But it's really not very much like Christianity.
Right,
if you go to the Gospels, it's incredible. It's almost nursery school level, the things that Jesus says about prayer. I mean, he tells stories about a lady who keeps coming and knocking on the same door over and over and over again because finally she'll be heard.
Yeah.
Well, it's... or then there's another story about the Gospels giving us the carrot instead of the stick. Jesus in the Gospels is always saying, if you really want a big reward, instead of a piddling reward that only lasts for a little while here on earth, if you really want a big reward, crowns and all the rest of it.
Rod, we're going to break right now, but we'll come back to this in just a minute, okay? Listening to Connect with the Dots. We'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm host Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've been talking about prayer, and yeah, the mysterious ways in which the New Testament talks about prayer. There are a lot of questions that arise with prayer. You know, little kids don't often ask these questions because there is something that makes perfect sense about prayer. You know, you want to talk to God, and God says, great, let's talk. You know, and that's...
Well, you can outsmart yourself. In other words, if you sit around thinking up these theories of prayer, it's like sitting down with somebody and saying, now let's have a really good talk, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Into the talk. You don't need a theory of talk before you get started, you know?
Yeah, and it's, you know, what it comes back to, I think, of course, is that prayer is about relationship. That's the first thing to understand about prayer. God desires a relationship with us. And so how do you have a relationship? Well, if you're a human being, you talk to people. That's how it's done, you know? And so, of course, you're not informing God of things that he didn't know. You know, you're not talking God into loving you. These are all things that when you think about it, you realize. But at the same time, you know, one of the things that Jesus does is he teaches in these really weird ways sometimes. I always go back to there's a moment in one of the Douglas Adams Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy books where something happens and this gigantic whale materializes in midair but the way he describes it is in typical Douglas Adams way. He says that the whale hung in the air in exactly the way a brick doesn't. I've always thought that was a great description. And the thing is that Jesus will often use these really strange ways of making a point that are like that. So to give another example, there's a great moment at the beginning of The Quiet Man where John Wayne's character gets off the train. And all he wants to do, he just asks a passerby how to get to Innisfree. And all these Irish people all surround him because he's the Yankee standing there. And they all start giving him an advice. And the advice is always things like, you see that road there? And somebody points to the road. He says, yeah. He says, that's not the road to Innisfree. And it's like,
yeah,
okay,
it's a great
thank
thing.
You, you know?
Yeah.
And when Jesus teaches, a lot of times he will teach in this strange way where he'll go, so prayer, there's this widow that wants justice from a judge. And she goes and she bangs on that judge's door and the judge tells her to get lost. And she keeps going and going and banging on the door.
If I'm not mistaken, the gospel writer goes out of his way to call him an unjust judge.
He's an unjust judge, right.
And
the conclusion of the parable is that's exactly the way God isn't. And it's like, okay, you know, that was a really strange parable,
and,
you know.
And yet, it's a little more complicated than that. The point of the story is to keep going. Don't give up. Don't tire out. If you don't get your answer right away, keep praying. Ought always to pray and never to get tired, never to faint.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, the story does say God's not an unjust judge. It's right. A really lousy metaphor for God. But at the same time, if an unjust,
like this,
even an unjust judge will cave if you pester him long enough,
right.
then God will too.
That's right. But he'll use those kinds of images again. So, you know, who of you would give, you know, if your son came and asked for an egg, would give him a snake? And those kinds of things. And so, again, he'll use these odd sort of negative illustrations to say, these are all the ways that God isn't. Which, it turns out, a lot of times there can be real power in that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have, for example, we were talking about this before we went on vacation last week, where we talked about Scrooge. And Scrooge is shown, you know, all these terrible things, you know, culminating in the realization of his own death. And then he kind of has this epiphany and says, why show me these things if I'm past all hope? And so the point, again, is this kind of, it's this sort of via negativa realization that this is not what it's supposed to be like. And so what is it supposed to be like? And that that shows up a lot in Jesus's teaching on prayer. At the same time, of course, Jesus gives us lots of, you know, positive instruction on prayer as well. And of course, he gives us the great model prayer, the Lord's Prayer, which is kind of the Lord's Prayer has been called the perfect prayer. It summarizes all the things that prayer is supposed to do. And the first thing that the Lord's Prayer does is it says it's not really primarily about you asking for stuff. which is easy to forget, you know, that prayer, because we're so needy, we need all these things from God. But one of the things that the Lord's Prayer trains us to do is to say, yeah, before you get to give us this day our daily bread, wait, and first of all, pay attention to what's even more important than your daily bread? What's more important than your need for a job, your need for money, the desperate things that are clamoring for your attention? Those come after adoration. And so we begin, you know, simply by addressing ourselves to who God is, our Father. And that's already, that already situates us, I think, in a space that is important for us to remember. The very first words of the Our Father remind us that we're not alone. It's our Father. It's not my Father. So it's not just you going before God in the great void with no community around you at all. You're going before God along with all the other Christians in the world.
Yeah, as part of a family.
Yeah.
Sons and daughters. He's the Father. We're the sons and daughters.
Right. And he's the Father. It's not our master, our creator.
Which can often be taken for granted. The Old Testament prophets, even the greatest of them, don't call Father except in occasionally in a sort of a poetic way, with sort of a glancing blow.
Right.
When you get to, it's Jesus teaching the Our Father that brings into the world the conception of God as Father and
right.
us as brothers and sisters.
Right. It was a dramatic shift. Jesus calls God Father. Just in the Sermon on the Mount alone, he calls God Father more than, you know, all the Old Testament texts that ever speak of God as Father. And those are quite rare. And they're, at best, they're kind of metaphorical.
Yeah.
You know, so Isaiah says, you are our Father, we are the clay, and you are the potter. And it's fairly clear that Isaiah is speaking of God as Israel's Father in this kind of metaphorical sense, right along with the idea that God is a potter.
Well,
in other words,
yeah,
it's not really our Father.
This
right?
is rooted in the fact that... it's not just in the idea that before we knew that God was Father, we thought of him as Master and that we are his servants. It mm-hmm. is included that it does include that, but that's not the centrality of it. Part of it, this is real important for understanding the idea of the difference between begotten and created. When we come to, as somebody who wrote a book about Arianism, is sort of on my mind. But when you make something that's different than yourself, when you make a piece of artwork or you build a radio or something, the thing that you're building is not like you. You're making, you're creating, and it's begetting. And to be a father is to beget. Somebody who's begotten is like the father. In other words, a son is like his father in a way that a radio or a painting or something isn't. And so the idea of God as Father implies really important things about the nature of the relationship that's now possible through Christ that wasn't possible before when we were still his creation, the work of his hands, his handiwork.
Right, right. Yeah, and that, that really does come back to it. That's what Isaiah is getting at when he says that we are the clay and you are the potter. There's a remove in that relationship. It's not as intimate as what Jesus is talking about. We're up against a break, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back with Mr. Rod Bennett talking about prayer right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've been talking about prayer. And Rod, you just raised an interesting point, which I think is fascinating. And I think certainly we intuit that there's something to it. Go ahead
C.S. Lewis wrote an interesting passage where he speculated on whether our prayers were inside or outside of time. This is interesting to me because if you've listened to the show for any length of time, I dig time travel stuff. I get get spiritual insight from contemplating time travel stories. But C.S. Lewis was similar. I think he wrote a time machine story at one point. But he wondered whether you should. Well, okay, let's say that your relative, your wife or something, is away and going through some sort of ordeal, and you won't know the news. Let's say she's in the hospital fighting for her life, and you won't know whether she survived or not for 2 weeks. Let's say she's in some distant country and the message won't come out of the missionary land where she's serving or something. I could build a story, I guess. But in other words, can you pray for an event? Can you still pray for your event when you know that she's either died or survived 2 weeks ago? You just haven't got the news yet. Is it all right to pray that she'll? Is it all right to continue praying that she'll survive the operation, even though the thing's been settled one way or the other? You just don't know about it yet. And Lewis concluded that you could, that since God is outside of time, He takes your prayers into account, even though you haven't prayed them yet.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of fascinating, interesting stuff to mine out of that.
Yeah.
That we couldn't begin to do in the last few minutes of the show. But it concerns the nature of God. You'll hear there's a certain heresy that's floating around right now, not so much in Catholic circles, that with the idea that God is subject to time. The classical formulation, and the correct one, is that God is outside time, that time is one of the things God created, so he's entirely independent of it.
Right.
But there's for various reasons groups of people who think that God must travel along a timeline the way that we do. And that has important implications for how you understand God, even though it sounds pretty esoteric at first, you know.
Well,
but a God that's entirely outside time has no trouble taking account the prayers of somebody living 200 years after the event or 200 years before it into account in about something that is happening in what would be the present for somebody like me and you.
Right. Right. The only this is one of the things that C.S. Lewis points out is, of course, you can't pray if you know what the how things turned out.
Well, that turned out is maybe not a good way to say it, but I think one of the things that was asked about it was, I think a lady wrote to him or something and asked, could she pray that, was it all right to pray that her husband would be saved and go to heaven even though he died some years earlier? Was this all right?
Of course.
She never really knew, because of his illness or whatever, whether he ever came to a real faith or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know the details of it. But she was asking, is it wrong to pray for somebody, even though they might, all you know, it's all settled one way or the other already?
Yeah.
And how it turned out, I mean, you and I never know how something turns out very exhaustively. But also that implies that, not that chance was involved, but anyway.
Well, chance could be involved too. You know, but the thing is you can't, for example, you know, you can pray all you want that the Japanese don't attack Pearl Harbor on December 7th,
right.
1941, but they did.
In a one-time on universe.
Yeah. And so there are certain things that you can't, precisely because you know the event,
right.
And therefore you know what God chose to permit,
right?
And so if you're looking right at God saying, "I defy your will." I'm going to pray against the will.
Well,
you can pray all you want, but nonetheless, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor
on
December 7th, 1941.
But the idea that you, your petitions might be taken into account,
right?
About something that you feel anxiety about.
Right, and that's a different thing. And yes, absolutely. And we do this all the time, of course. You know, I'll hear something in the news. Some little kid has gone missing. So what do? Well, you pray for that. You pray for that little kid to be found, right? And it may be that
the child has already died.
Or has already been found.
In one sense, none of our business.
Right. Or it may be that the child has already been found, but you don't know that yet.
Right.
So did your prayers for them to find that child have anything to do with that child being found? Well,
that's right.
You're welcome to think so. You know,
because a God that's outside of time is not restricted by something like this.
Right. And that brings us, of course, into all kinds of esoteric places. But the point is, altogether, you know, the fact that God not only permits but commands petitionary prayer and says that our prayers really make a difference. You have not, says James, because you ask not.
Mm.
Wow. Really? Yeah. You know, your prayers actually matter to God. And so if you don't pray, one of the possible outcomes is that something that God intended for you to have won't come because you didn't ask for it. You didn't bother to care. And even that, of course, is ordered to our good. Because what it's all about, ultimately, it's about relationship. God is teaching you to pray. And so as you take that seriously, God honors our prayers. And it's not merely about changes in our circumstances. It is about changes in us as well.
Right. I didn't mean to imply earlier that it is that prayer doesn't change you. Of course it does.
Well, of course it does. Yeah.
But it's just, I was just pointing out that it's surprising how little of that tone there is in the New Testament.
Indeed. Yeah. It's really striking to me so often the kinds of things that Jesus teaches and the weird ways in which he teaches them, you know, these kind of unexpected outcomes to parables. So, you know, there's the guy that's looking to hire somebody. So he goes out and hires a bunch of guys, and then he keeps going and hiring more. And finally, he hires some guys to work for him for about 10 minutes, you know. And when it's all over, he pays everybody the same amount of money.
That one always gets a big reaction from people.
Yeah. People have been working all morning are like, these guys are just working for 10 minutes. He's going, what do you care? And it's a really striking answer. What do you care if I'm generous with my money? Oh, well, I never thought of it that way. Yeah.
Right.
I'm not cheating you. I'm giving you what you agreed to, you know.
And that's really, it was Chesterton, I think, who said, we don't need a church that's right where we're right. We need a church that's right where we're wrong.
Yes, indeed. Indeed.
And when you hear Christ saying things that you don't understand, that seem odd to you, that you disagree with, there's a learning opportunity in there, you know. Just the moments when you disagree with God that test whether, you know, he gets to be right and you get to be wrong or not, whether you're willing to live with that.
Yeah.
And also docility and on our part towards the teacher knowing more than we do.
Right. Well, and that's part of the purpose of prayer as well.
Yeah.
It's just learning exactly that kind of docility. Docility. To be docile. That is not American, man.
It's true.
Docile. Sheep are docile, you know.
Right.
And yet, that is something that is commended for us. And all it really means, it doesn't mean that you turn your brain off. It just means that you are willing to listen to what God has to say.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was one of the striking moments in my conversion process was that when I right in my early stages, I think I was still in RCIA, I had decided to be Catholic but was still a catechumen.
Right.
I started grappling for the first time with the John Paul II Catechism, the 92 Catechism of the Catholic Church, and pretty strong words against the death penalty, which I had believed in up to that point.
Okay.
I realized that here was the catechism saying, you need to shut up about that, Rod. And that was a new experience for me as a Christian. As a Protestant, your religion and your opinion were pretty much the same thing.
Right.
You went and joined whatever church you felt was the right one based on your opinion of what church is the right one.
Telling you what you already thought, yeah.
And you never ran up to a moment where he says, look, I'm God and you're not. You missed a step, Rod. Sorry. that had never happened to me before, and it was a new experience.
Well, we are, and on that note, we have to conclude, but I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Rod. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today was Danny Head. I was your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back tomorrow with Mr. Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a good evening.
So long, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.